to AAA Sky. Today, we're discussing the history of the telescope with historian and AAA Executive Vice President Art Fried. I'm Stanley Furtick.
And I'm Irene Pease. AAA Sky is produced by the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York, whose mission is to promote the study of astronomy and to emphasize its cultural and inspirational values. Find out more at AAA.org.
First, here's a word from the president of the AAA, Brian Berg.
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of AAA Sky, the official podcast of the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York. I am Brian Berg, president of the association. How great were the first two episodes of AAA Sky? Weren't they just fantastic? I was so excited hearing them and listening to them and knowing that we're doing this and bringing this to everybody. Man, oh man, am I excited, as is everyone here at AAA, and I hope that all of you listening are also. In this episode, we have the Vice President of AAA, Bart Fried, who will be talking about telescopes. This man knows everything there is to know about telescopes. He is a fountain of information, and he will be sharing his knowledge with all of you about all things telescope, from the history of telescopes and how telescopes work to modern-day telescopes, the very heart of astronomy. Fantastic stuff. Like Galileo, AAA did not invent the podcast, but we are improving it, we're making it better, and we're hopefully putting information out there to make the world a more informed and fun place. I sincerely hope that everybody is enjoying these podcasts, and please, any questions, comments, suggestions that anybody has, go to AAA.org or go to AAASky.nyc, and please let us know your thoughts. With that, Stan and Irene, take it away.
Our guest today is our very own Bart Fried. Bart is Executive Vice President of the Amateur Astronomers Association, as well as a former AAA board member. He's an avid observational astronomer. Bart's also a renowned historian whose field of research is the history of the telescope. He also collects and restores antique scopes. In fact, in 1991, Bart founded the Antique Telescope Society and served two terms as its president. In addition to the AAA, he's a life member of the Delaware Valley Amateur Astronomers, former board member of the Custer Institute, a member of the Astronomical Society of Long Island, and a member of the Amateur Observer Society of New York. When he's not spending his time on telescopes, Bart has found the time to be a successful international businessman as well as a professional landscape architect. We spoke to Bart at his home via Zoom. Hello, Bart. Welcome to AAA Sky.
Hi, Stanley. It's a pleasure to be here.
Bart, you're our resident expert on the history of telescopes. So can you tell us a bit about the invention of the telescope? I mean, although Galileo made it famous, he wasn't its inventor. So how did it come about?
Well, the true inventor is a fellow named Hans Lipperhey, who in 1608 presented a telescope to Prince Maurits in the Netherlands. And the rumor or the legend is that his children were playing in his shop. He was a spectacle maker. There were a number of spectacle makers in Middelburg in Holland. And supposedly they were playing with two lenses and they saw a church steeple and they told their dad about it. And then he figured out how to make a telescope. But the reality is there's absolutely no evidence of that. So Lipperhey showed his invention to Prince Maurits and asked for a patent, but was turned down because within a week or two, several other people came forward with very similar inventions. So either the word got out right away or there were a number of people working on it, on the problem at the same time.
Maybe it was the kids who told their friends at school, if they went to school.
Yeah, that's, I guess, possible. The interesting thing is that there is a record or a pamphlet that came out about 3 weeks later, because the telescope was shown during a visit from some dignitaries, And that was the main part of this pamphlet. Was it's like a newsletter that came out about this visit. And then at the very end, in about one or two paragraphs, they mentioned the introduction or this showing of a telescope, and in which they said you could see more stars in the sky than were visible due to the feebleness of your own eyes. So right off the bat, the first telescope was used to look up as well as out.
Ah, so Galileo wasn't the first person to aim it at the heavens.
No, Galileo did a lot with it, but actually there were a couple of people who looked up before he did. He didn't really get a hold of the information about the telescope until early in 1609. But by then, they were already being sold in Paris. 3 months after the invention, there were crude telescopes in the flea markets and stalls of Paris.
So he made some improvements to it, though, didn't he?
Yes, he figured out a better way to make it. He didn't actually see one. What he did was he got information through the church network, the grapevine, so to speak, instantly understood the optics of it, made a better version of it.
But were there precursors to the first telescope? I mean, where did the name telescope come from?
Well, those two questions. The first question is, yes, the understanding of optics went back thousands of years. There was a crystal lens that was produced around 700 BCE called the Nimrud crystal lens. It's now in the British Museum. And so the Assyrians certainly understood something about optics. They were reflecting concave mirrors that were used as burning mirrors. And for example, Seneca, a great scientist and philosopher, in 4 BC, he described magnification by a globe filled with water and said that letters, however small and indistinct, are seen enlarged and more clearly through a globe of glass filled with water. But by the 13th century, eyeglasses had been invented. So optics and optical polishing and lens work was around.
Right.
But the difficulty was in producing optics with concave surfaces.
So can you tell us, how did the telescope first get its name?
Yes, actually, interestingly, it was not from the guy who invented it, nor was it from the person who very early on made it popular, which was Galileo. However, there is a Galileo connection to it. In 1611, just a few years after Galileo made many of his early astronomical discoveries with the telescope, there was a banquet given in his honor by Prince Federico Cesi. And at that banquet was another guest, a Greek court mathematician named John Domitiani. Domitiani was one that the fellow that actually coined the word, the Greek word telescopos. And Cesi apparently really liked that word, and he more or less proclaimed that that should be what the instrument is to be called. What I don't know is whether there was any politics involved, you know, related to Domitiani being there at the party. But in any event, when you're a prince, if you say that's what we're going to call it, that's what everybody there is going to call it.
It's good to be king, or a prince in this case. So the first telescopes, I mean, Galileo's and the ones before him, the ones of his time, were refractors using lenses to focus the light.
Correct.
Was Sir Isaac Newton the first to invent a telescope using mirrors instead of lenses? Because, I mean, the most common, or the most well-known, or the simplest, I should say, reflector is the Newtonian telescope. So was he the inventor of that?
Nope. He gets credit for it, but not because he invented it. The first reflector was actually invented in 1616, only 8 years after the first refractor. And it was presented designed by a fellow named Zucchi, Z-U-C-C-H-I, in Italy. But he didn't really publish much. He did he did publish it, but it wasn't widely published. So it was more or less forgotten for quite a while. There were some other reflecting telescope designs that came out before Newton, but they were more difficult and nobody could produce them, and they didn't really work.
Huh, that's surprising.
So Newton, he incorrectly deduced through observation and experimentation, but bad experimentation, that you could not bring all of the rays, all the colors of light together to a single focus using, let's say, two different pieces of glass or glass and maybe a liquid-filled lens. They tried all kinds of combinations to try and get all the colors of light to a single focus.
Well, you're talking about chromatic aberration in a right. simple telescope lens.
Correct. A simple lens, a single element lens, will not focus all the colors to the same focal point. So then when you look at an object, it has color fringes and it tends to be blurry. Now, the way around that is you can either make the telescope excruciatingly long and then the focal points come very nearly to the same spot. And that created a situation where in the 1600s, they had these hugely long telescopes called aerial telescopes where they would hang a lens up on a pole and then the eyepiece might be 15, 20, 30, even as much as 100 feet away. And they were really ungainly and hard to use. However,
difficult to slew.
Yeah. However, it's not to say that there weren't some astronomical discoveries made with them, but they were really ungainly. So the need for a shorter instrument was clearly there.
Right.
And so Sir Isaac, before he was Sir Isaac, made one of his great blunders in that he said, no, there's no way to make a refractor into a colorless image. So let's turn to the reflector because we can focus the light by one surface of the reflector and get all the colors, you know, to the same focal point.
Right.
So he set back the refractor by nearly 50 years of development, but
because he was Isaac Newton proclaiming that this was never going to happen.
Right. His reputation was such that nobody could really argue with him, except maybe Robert Hooke. But they had a lot of fights. So he made a telescope. It was very small. It was only a couple inches in diameter for the speculum metal surface. And his claim to fame really is that he put a secondary to pick off the light and push it out the side to an eyepiece.
Right.
He showed it to the Royal Society, and they loved it.
And that's the Newtonian telescope.
And that became the Newtonian telescope. So everybody thinks he invented the reflector, but he wasn't even close.
So this was Newton's biggest blunder?
Yep.
I mean, so he's in good company with Einstein, who made a blunder or two, too.
Right. We're seeing a trend here where, you know, Galileo didn't invent the refractor. Newton did not invent the reflector, but they get a lot of credit for it.
Well, you know, I think Galileo and Newton and Einstein deserve all the credit they get without any doubt.
Yeah.
So I think, well, after Newton, as I recall, there were some other also very clever Englishmen who enter into the picture.
Well, the problem that Newton created and then fixed by developing a working reflector, and it really was the first, we shouldn't badmouth Newton, it was the first really working reflector.
Right.
There were many reflector designs that nobody could make. They couldn't produce the surfaces accurate enough to get good images out of them. They could get images, but not good images.
Right.
So these designs were abandoned. Gregory, for example, and the Gregorian telescope. Well, Gregory never made a Gregorian, even though he developed the design.
You mean the Pope Gregory?
No, Gregory the optician.
Ah.
John Gregory. So, but Sir Isaac, by saying you couldn't do it, didn't mean that everybody else abandoned the idea, because there were mathematicians around who said, theoretically, you should be able to get most of the colors with using two pieces of glass and making an achromatic lens. You should be able to do it. But the guy who really did it first was a country gentleman who was wealthy. He was a landowner and he was a lawyer, but he was really an outstanding, a superb mathematician. And his name was Chester Moore Hall. And so Moore Hall, he realized that the eye could get rid of color. Why can't a telescope get rid of color? So he tackled the problem and he realized that what you need are two pieces of glass with widely divergent chromatic dispersion characteristics. Right. And then with indices of refraction that would allow you to correct for spherical aberration. So he
chromatic aberration.
Well, both, no, chromatic and spherical, both. Right. You have to solve both problems.
Yes.
So what he did was he figured that there was flint glass, which is really lead crystal, would work in conjunction with crown glass, which is just bottle glass. And by shaping the two properly, you could bring most of the rays of light together. Now, he was not a practical optician. So he went into town, went into London, and he found two different opticians, one to make the flint and one to make the crown. And they were both very busy.
And he did this to keep it a secret?
Yeah, more or less to keep it a secret. And but they were both very busy. And as it turns out, both opticians shopped it out to a third optician.
They subcontracted.
They both subcontracted the work to a third optician who was able to literally put one and one together to make, I'll say one plus, you know, to make an achromat. He figured that these two pieces of glass fit together. They had the same R2 and R3 curves. Right. And would made up. And so he figured it out right away. So the cat was already out of the bag when the very first achromat was produced. Now, this was around 1732, I think, was when he went to the, when he started producing them. Actually, maybe even earlier, around 1728. So this was a problem because he was wealthy. He didn't really need to go into the business of being a telescope maker, but he was very much interested in the problem. So he hired another optician named Ascoff to start producing some telescopes. But Ascoff died almost at the same time he got hired. So there are no known Chester Moore Hall telescopes. We do know that he made or had made for him more than maybe about a handful or more of achromatic lenses.
Right.
Now, if the problem is that along comes John Dollond. He's one of the guys that was attacking this problem mathematically. He knew Chester Moore Hall. He was certainly aware of the doublets that Hall had made. He even admitted that. But he started making them. He made better ones. He was a better optician, and he really thoroughly understood the math behind it.
Right.
So he starts making really high quality doublet achromats. And then his son convinces him that they should file a patent. So they file a patent, but by now the Worshipful Society of Spectacle Makers in London all knew about it and were making their own achromats. So they challenged the patent in court.
Understandably.
And one would think that because these had been made for a number of years and there were so many people that knew about it and were making it, that this patent application stood no chance. But the reverse occurred. The judge found in favor of John Dollond because he said that it wasn't the man who invented it and then locked it away in his scrutoir. That's the word the judge used, which is a writing desk. So yes. The patent was not deserved by the guy who locked it up. It was deserved by the guy who was bringing it to the good of the world. And John Dollond was cranking them out by then.
I imagine that court case is probably studied in every law school around the world.
It is known as a landmark case in patent law. That is correct.
So with telescopes, generally speaking, other things being equal, bigger is better. So what were the limitations in making early telescopes? Why was it difficult to make large ones?
Well, it was as a matter of raw material. In order to make a good lens, you need good glass. And in the case of an achromat, you need two different types of good glass. You need good flint and good crown. So the problem is that as glass cools, it does not necessarily cool evenly. And also, when you mix all the raw materials and you melt them, they don't necessarily mix well. It's a very thick, gooey kind of substance when it's molten.
I can imagine.
So fortunately, in the 1700s, a fellow by the name of Guignon, who was a Swiss watchmaker, also was interested in telescopes and was making some lenses. And in order to make better lenses, he figured out he's got to make better glass. So he starts working on the problem of producing better glass. Right. And he realized that the trick was to stir it. You want to stir the glass as it cools in the pot that you've made your batch of raw glass in. But as it cools, it gets thicker and thicker and right. harder and harder. And then the other problem is, so you need a heavy, solid rod to stir it. But metal, especially if it's iron, will contaminate the glass. Even a uh-huh. trace amount of iron will turn it green. This was a real problem, is what do we stir this stuff with? And it's too hot to use almost any other material anyway. Mm-hmm. But he came upon the idea that he could coat his rod, his stirring rod, with the same material that lined the pot that you melt the raw materials in. This is called fire clay. And it's basically pottery. So you line this, your metal pot with pottery.
It's ceramic.
Ceramic, exactly. Yeah. And that does not react with the glass.
Right.
So what he did was he decided, well, you know what? I'm going to coat this rod with the same ceramic material. Then I could stir all day long until it gets just too thick to stir. So that gets rid of the inhomogeneity in the glass. It brings the bubbles up to the surface. It brings up all of the impurities and dust and dirt and things that are in the glass. And in the center of the block of glass, when you cut away the top and the sides and the bottom, you got a very nice, homogeneous, uniform piece of glass.
So there's something to be said for stirring the pot.
Exactly. That's exactly.
So let's step back a bit. In the list of great human inventions, how important do you see the telescope as being?
The short answer is I think it's number one, but you would say, well, maybe I'm biased because I'm interested in telescopes, but
no, not at all.
here's why I think it's number one. There have been, you know, obviously major landmark inventions in human history. Fire, people usually say is number one because it warmed us, that we could cook our food and, it lit our camps at night and it made us fairly human. And there's a good argument for that. And the wheel is another one, right? You know, or irrigation. You know, there's some major...
Well, agriculture in general.
Agriculture in general, right. However, humans were around long before all of those inventions. And we were slowly but surely developing anyway. But if you can imagine yourself sitting in a room and all the shades are drawn and the curtains are closed and you've spent your entire life in this room, all you know in your existence are the walls and the ceiling and the floor around you. And then somebody comes in the room and they throw open the curtains and throw open the blinds and you can look out into the beautiful world that you've never been able to see because you've been shut into this room. So my analogy is that is humanity up until the invention of the telescope. All we knew at night was there are little pinpoints of light that don't move except with the rotation of the Earth. And there's a couple of them that sort of wander around a little bit. There were only five at the time known.
Right.
And we didn't know what they were. They were just moving dots. And a little bit, some of them were brighter than others. So we knew nothing. We didn't have any idea of our place in the universe and who we really were. And in, as we found out later, how insignificant we are. But it, so before you have humanity before the telescope and humanity after the telescope. And the two are completely different things.
Yeah, that's kind of the history of astronomy right there. So we, there is one last question, which we like to ask all of our guests, which is not necessarily related to telescopes or astronomy, which is, as a New Yorker, by adoption, I guess, what's your favorite spot in New York?
When I moved to New York, I met a guy who told me he goes surfing, and I thought, well, that's crazy. And then he said, well, no, we got beaches all over the place. So I started going to the beaches in New York, Jacob Riis and the Rockaways. And then there's a couple that are a little bit further out, not actually in New York City. But so without a doubt, my favorite part of New York is the fact that it's surrounded by water, including some great beaches. I mean, the rivers and the harbors are great too. And I guess just last week there was a whale going up the Hudson.
Really?
Yeah, humpback whale showed up in the Hudson. So yeah, going to the beach is my favorite part of living in New York City.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bart, for enlightening us. Maybe we can bring you back later to do a history of the telescope part two about the development of telescopes in the 20th century.
Well, that would be my pleasure, and thank you very much. I really enjoyed being with you today.
So I'm reminded of James Burke's television series, Connections. If you don't know, he's this historian, and he weaves stories of history of science using seemingly loosely related or even unrelated topics and kind of bringing things full circle to, you know, where we are today with some science topic or concept or invention. And just listening to this discussion between you and Bart, it kind of reminded me that, like, yes, the main topic was the history of the telescope, but you also weaved in these other things, like we heard about, like physics of optics and a little bit of materials and fabrication and mathematics and some patent law and just a dash of entomology. So for me, it was really fun hearing this kind of full bouquet of subjects that are all part of this story of history.
Yeah, and in all of that, I'm glad Bart was able to set the story straight about some misconceptions that a lot of people have regarding the invention of the telescope or different kinds of telescopes. I mean, both Galileo and Newton were definitely involved in these inventions, but they weren't the sole creators of them.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing like more about the actual people. Like, we get these stories passed down and it almost seems displaced, but knowing like these are people and they have personalities, and especially like with Hooke and Newton, like just hearing, I know Bart mentioned like, oh yeah, they kind of clashed a little bit. So I mean, I heard they were both kind of temperamental personalities that just did not go well together. So that's kind of fun, like a more personal touch to the stories.
Yeah, my favorite part of this was the story about the optician who received two orders, subcontracts from two other opticians who had each separately been hired by Chester Moore Hall to create his first achromatic lens. So I looked him up after speaking to Bart, and his name, the fellow that figured this out, was George Bess. And yes, he received the two orders from the two other opticians, and he made the thing, figured out what it was for, and then he tested it, and he saw that indeed different color light does converge to the same focal point with this. So then he went and he told John Dollond about it, and then the rest is history.
That was a really, really fascinating story. Like, he literally put, as you said, like two and two together, he put R2 and R3 together. So those two radii of curvature of the two pieces of glass, one concave, one convex, and said, these are the same curvature. These must go together. Boom. There you go. So, I mean, as soon as I hear like pieces of glass, like I think, yeah, that's a telescope. And it was funny that Bart mentioned, right, that one of his favorite things about New York City is the beaches. Because I know Bart and sand and beaches and even fires on the beaches. I think he's told a story about, you know, just sitting by a fire on a beach and just saying that, you know, with fire and sand, you can know the universe. And I think that's just such a beautiful and complete picture.
And now, here's Irene's celestial forecast.
Thanks, Stanley. Checking in with the planets. Mercury and Venus are drowned out by the glow of Sol. Although Mercury has a great elongation, the small angle of the morning ecliptic above the horizon makes Mercury a tough target. Venus is at apogee, its farthest distance from the Earth, on March 25th, so don't expect to see it anytime soon. The moon is next to Mars on the night of the 19th, and there's the added bonus of an ISS pass visible from New York City at 7:48 Eastern from south-southwest to east-northeast. The station will pass Procyon, peaking at 54 degrees altitude, and buzz the beehive on this pass. If you miss it on the 19th, watch again on the 20th or 21st for lower evening passes. Check the ISS Finder app or similar for more details about when and where to look. Jupiter and Saturn are out in the early morning. On March 18th, Jupiter is camera ready with its four large moons gathered in close and the red spot facing our way. Uranus is still in Aries, still has rings, and I still can't see them. For our daytime astronomy, well, there's more of it. The equinox occurs Saturday, March 20th. It's 5:37 a.m. Eastern time. That's when the sun, moving along the ecliptic, passes the celestial equator. Post-equinox, daylight outlasts darkness until the autumnal equinox in September. And the featured constellation is Serpens. If you're outside at 2 a.m., which for the next 7.5 months we've collectively agreed to pretend is 3 a.m., you'll notice the split serpent rising off the eastern horizon. Perfectly nice constellation, which is needlessly interrupted by Ophiuchus, much like our circadian rhythm is by daylight savings, which isn't even really so much saving as it is shifting, so let's not fool ourselves. But anyway, rather than connecting the dots to keep the serpent continuous, it's separated into serpent's caput, the serpent's head, and serpent's cauda, the serpent's tail. Cauda and caput collectively span 3.5 hours of right ascension, with the tail nearly touching the galactic plane and the head halfway to the North Galactic Pole, an impressive reach. So take a cue from the serpent. If you're feeling a little sleep deprived from our time shift, maybe a nice full stretch will help refresh you. And that's your celestial forecast. Back to you, Stanley.
And that's our show. Tune in next time when we discuss the recent Mars arrivals with Dr. Jana Gersovich.
AAA Sky audio editing and original music is by Preston Staley. Our technical producer is Parker Bossier.